has a terrific story to share with us. So please welcome Joe.
Hey, Joe.
Welcome, everyone. I'm glad you could make it out today. My name's Joe P., and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Joe.
We love
you,
Joe.
If you happen to be here... Thank you. If you happen to be here in June of 2013, that was the one and only other time I spoke at this speaker meeting, and the story will probably be pretty similar. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to extend thanks to God, to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, to my sponsor, Chrissy, to my home group, Castle Hills Group, that meets on Monday nights over at Covenant Presbyterian Church, to my lovely wife, Raquel, and to all the friends and people who've made it possible for me to enjoy this journey of sobriety. I'd like to greet the newcomers and invite them to join us on this journey. There's a little passage I'd like to read from page 162. It says, "Thus we grow, and so can you, though you be but one man with this book in his hand. We believe and hope it contains all you need, or all you will need to begin. We know what you are thinking. You are saying to yourself, 'I'm jittery and alone. I couldn't do that.' But you can. You forget that you have just now tapped a source of power much greater than yourself. To duplicate with such backing what we have accomplished is only a matter of willingness, patience, and labor." I was born in April 21st, 1971, in Pittsburgh, California, which is in the Bay Area, the East Bay, kind of industrial area, kind of late towards the later part of the Vietnam War. Love and flowers and peace and anti-war were in the air. My parents, my mom was from California, and she grew up, I wouldn't say well-to-do, but upper middle class. My dad was kind of a hick from Oklahoma City, a motorcycle guy, and they met at some drug dealer's house and fell in love. And so they were together for a while and enjoying themselves. And one day they heard a knock at the door, and they went and answered the phone, and this Methodist preacher named Reverend Younger knocked on the door and asked them if they knew Jesus. And they said no. And so they decided to get saved and become Christians and start living a Christian life. And they were so enthusiastic about it that 6 months later, they packed up their El Camino and drove to Dallas to go to Christ for the Nations Institute. And so that was the new life for them. I was there. I was their firstborn. And we were in Dallas now. I don't remember any of this. But when I was about six, my dad started working as an assistant manager at Long John Silver's and started smoking pot with the guys. And it wasn't long before he was in and out of jails and having a lot of trouble, and they got a divorce when I was nine. Now, my mom was then and has always been what you would call a devout kind of evangelical Christian type. In fact, right now, she and my stepdad are in Nicaragua, where they live 8 months out of the year doing missions work. And so I grew up in that kind of a household that was very religious. It wasn't necessarily very constrictive to an extent. I don't remember a childhood that was uncomfortable. But my mom married my stepdad a year later that she met through some babysitters, a friend of babysitters. He was a fun-loving big guy that had a lot of experience and seemed to be good with kids. And so it didn't take long, and we moved up to Minneapolis. And we're in Minneapolis, and then his different sides started to come out. And my dad had also been kind of an angry guy at times. And so I grew up, like, on the one hand, I had, like, Andre Crouch music in the background. But then also I had my dad, like, in his fits of rage with cursing. And so I remember I've always had a cuss mouth when I get angry since I was a kid. And my stepdad, he was an alcoholic, but I think he was an adult child of an alcoholic. And so he had his issues. His main issues were rage and that he couldn't keep a job. But so I'm up there, and I'm going to private Christian schools, as I did for the majority of my elementary school and junior high. And everything's going along pretty good. But when I got to be about 13 or 14, I started to realize that, like, why are the other kids wearing Izods and polos and driving BMWs? And, like, we're driving this old, like, Chrysler LeBaron station wagon with the fake wood paneling is peeling off. And it was just, I started to realize that we were poor, or maybe not poor, let's just say we were lower middle class, and I felt different. That was one way I felt different. Plus, we couldn't listen to any secular music, And I saw the cool kids at the high school, in the Christian school, that would drink and stuff like that. And it was completely different than the life we had. And I started to suddenly feel like a lack of unity and a lack of desire to want to be the kind of person I was with the family I was. And I started to identify or more want to emulate these guys that I would see at the in the high school age at the Christian school. I ended up getting kicked out of a couple of Christian schools just for bad behavior, trying to be a funny class clown kind of guy. And the funny thing was I was a gregarious person, but I was also became a shy person. I had my bones grew faster than my frame, like a lot of people, and I got these huge buck teeth. And I was really skinny, and I was also kind of shy in class, and so I sort of just had some issues there, personality-wise. But I started getting in trouble and trying to hang out with kids and look for acceptance in certain ways. Anyway, my first experience with alcohol came. I was 14 years old. We were going to the private Christian school, but we went to this church where there were some public school kids, too. And this girl, Sunday, invited me to this party where there was going to be alcohol. It was back in the Motley Crue days, and Rat, and all that. So I went to this party, and we drank some stuff, like Yukon Jack, I remember was one of them, like liquor cabinets, stuff that had been stolen. And we drank all this stuff before we went, and then we went to the party. It was in somebody's big house with a pool. And next thing I remember, I was face down in the back seat of my parents' car in our driveway, and there was like vomit all down there. And so my parents had to come get me, and it had ruined this ninth grade end party. And that was my first experience with alcohol. And so I can say the first thing that happened with me is when I drank, I felt this euphoric effect, but I just wanted to keep drinking, you know. And the majority of kids weren't passed out drunk, so that kind of indicated a difference that I see in hindsight right away, that I had this desire to just keep, more would be better. So I kind of skulked around in the malls and stuff for the rest of that summer. We moved down to Tulsa, Oklahoma, Broken Arrow specifically, in 86. And by then I started working out, and my black teeth kind of grew in a little bit, so I felt a little more confident. I started going to public school, and I'd always made good grades, but I started kind of running around with the bad kids a little bit, or looking for fun and looking to drink. My mom and stepdad got a divorce, which was great. She was always working, so I could always kind of just do whatever I wanted. And so I'd sneak out and run around, and I had this girlfriend, and we would drink beer and stuff like that. And one night she said, why do we always, we were getting ready to go out on a Friday night, she said, you know, this is boring. All we ever do is go out and drink beer, and we get people to buy it for us. I said, well, what do you want to do? And she said, well, this guy from OU is down, Holly's boyfriend, and he's got some, I forget what she called it, but some pot. And drugs? Are you serious? That's disgusting. I couldn't believe you wanted to do drugs. And you know, 2 hours later, we're in my closet smoking a Dr. Pepper can. And it was the best night, one of the best nights of my life in terms of the euphoria and the fun we had. I'd never heard Led Zeppelin before, and we were listening to Black Dog. And it was just great. It was a really, really fun night. But like 9 months later, the girlfriend's gone, and I'm like dropped out of my first of 2 semesters of high school because I'm smoking pot all the time. And I'm just completely lazy. And all I want to do is get high. And even my pot smoking friends don't want to hang out with me, or they'll make fun of me when we do, because when I sit there, I thought they could hear, like, they could hear my thoughts. And I was always by myself all the time. And so I was really paranoid. And one night we went out, and we're driving around on New Year's Eve 89, and we're on the far west side of Tulsa on these hills. And I never really listened to really hard rock like Metallica, but they had Metallica going, and we're tripping acid. And I'd had good acid trips before, but this time I had all of a sudden, I felt wind blowing through me, and all of a sudden I could hear the devil talking to me. And I knew, all of a sudden I realized that if I didn't join up with the devil, that these guys were going to stab me to death. And I knew in a way, a spiritual way, that you couldn't defy logic. And somehow I got away from those guys, and I ran home. And I told my mom everything, and I was so scared. And so she took me to this guy that used to be a drug dealer, but now he was a Christian, that she knew from church. And that night we sat there, and I talked to this guy, and he had like a big white horse on the wall, and we're like talking, and I wanted to be with Jesus, and it was wonderful. And so I knew how my new life was going to be. I was 17, and I was going to go back to school and just be this Christian guy. But the thing was, is like the next day I was smoked pot because I didn't feel okay. After the high wore off and everything, I just went back to what I knew. So this went on for like about 7 years. I went to Oral Roberts University and dropped out because of pot smoking. And I went to the University of Tulsa after a semester. And I was waiting tables at the time. And I was really having trouble with my life. It took me 7 years to graduate from undergraduate with a 4-year degree because I kept dropping classes and I was just really taking my time. But something wonderful happened in 95. I could not stand the marijuana anymore because it made me so paranoid. I just couldn't take it. Anytime I smoked it, I felt like people could hear my thoughts and it was too weird. And so I started drinking. And before I drank recreationally, in my opinion, compared to this new way I began to drink, but it sort of started out as binge drinking, and I would go to college, and I would go to my classes, and I would go to the Baptist Student Union and try to be a part of that group. But then every once in a while, I would just feel like this. It just felt like I needed to like scratch an itch or just kind of take a break or take a shower. I can't explain it, but it just felt like I just needed a break for a bit. So I would check into a hotel with a bunch of liquor for the weekend and get blasted, and then I would be good again. And so I sort of was on this binge period for a while, but that was disruptive to my life. And at some point along the way, I suddenly realized that if I drank some every night, I wouldn't have this disruptive roller coaster thing. And I thought about movies I'd seen where guys like, James Bond or whatever would have their little cocktail at night, and yet they had beautiful families and wonderful, successful lives and interesting lives, and so that made sense. So I bought some big things of liquor and kept them in my dorm room, and I would drink at night, and all of a sudden I became very successful. I killed the MCAT test. I started getting A's in my classes. I got involved in the Senate. I was a senator for my dorm. I did all this stuff to pad my resume because I was trying to get into medical school. And had a girlfriend, and it was really working out great. And things were going good. I got accepted into medical school. And I kind of started fumbling that last year. I thought it was just senioritis a little bit. I remember in December of 96, my girlfriend, who became my wife later, sat me down after we'd been dating about a month and said, "Look, my friends are telling me that you drink a lot, and I just want you to know that I just want you to not drink so much, And I said, "Oh, no problem. I don't even need to drink." And so I actually went from January through July of 97 without touching a drop of alcohol and just enjoying the relationship and stuff with her and the successes that I was having in my life. I was really into fitness at the time, running a lot and stuff, training for triathlons. And so things were good. And I remember in July of 97, I think she was fully convinced that I was fine now. And I had just kind of had a rough patch. And so one night we got some beers or something. And after that, we were living separately. But she didn't know that I started drinking every night after that. Just a little after I would hang out with her and her family and do my school. So I got accepted into medical school. We got married 3 days before medical school in August of 98. And I started, and we moved in together, and that was her first realization that I was a date nightly drinker. And she was shocked, and it didn't go over well. We got two separations, and then I stayed in the apartment, and she moved out and bought a house. And so I was there doing my thing, and what I found was I had been really motivated in undergraduate to go to class and work hard, but suddenly all I wanted to do was figure out how to play the electric guitar and look for tools at pawn shops and drink beer. And so I never went to class, or rarely went to class. And so they had to ask me to take a break from the year of medical school and come back next year. So that gave me lots of time to do my thing. And meanwhile, I'm racking up all these loans because I'm not working, all these education loans. And so I go back, and I passed some classes I needed to over the summer and went back my first year again. Or I think maybe I was in my second year. I can't remember. I was in my second year now. And same thing. And so by October of that second year, they said, "You need to go." I remember the dean sitting me down, and I was telling him, "Look, I might have a problem with alcohol." And he said, "You know what?" He said, "Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me." And that was it. And so that career was over. And in a way, I was relieved. I was disappointed, but at the same time, I was relieved because it just felt like so much pressure. And I thought if I just got a regular job, 9-to-5 job, that I would be fine. And maybe that wasn't for me. So up in Tulsa, there's a lot of oil and gas still. And so I wound up as an administrative assistant for a gas accounting group in this energy marketing and trading firm. And it was pretty cool. It was on the trade floor. It was before the big Enron gas and oil, gas and power crash. And so I was enjoying that. And my wife and I had gotten back together. I moved into the house with her. And what I had done is I had this new system where we could live together happily. It's a lot of the time, some of the time I wouldn't drink. And we'd always go to the Southern Baptist Church together and with her family. But sometimes I needed to drink. And so what I finally decided to do was I would run home when I knew she was at work, and I would buy like 6 huge bottles of orange diet slice and some vodka. And I'd mix them up, and I'd hide them all over the house. And then when she'd go to bed, like at 10 o'clock, I would sit there with my nacho cheese chips and my drink, and I would sit there and drink that until I was sleepy, and then go to bed. And it worked out pretty well for a long time. And then after about 2.5 years of that, I suddenly just had this like terrible moment of clarity where I felt like I was living this dishonest life. I was lying to, you know, the people I cared about. And so I sat her and my mom down and I told them everything. And I thought this was good, you know, because I didn't want to drink. And the problem was that 4 or 5 days later, I suddenly wanted to drink again. And I poured everything out. But now, like, she was on to me, and she felt hurt and betrayed, and she was suspicious. And so she would come home sometimes and find me there with a 6-pack, and it was just all the Al-Anon stuff. Like, she'd follow me to the liquor store, and it was just... it was uncomfortable. And in about 2003, she said, "Look, if you drink again, we're done." And, you know, we dated for 2 years. We've been married. We ended up being married for 6 years. But we went on this ski trip in March of 2004, and it was just a disaster. I got altitude sickness and just really acted like threw a lot of tantrums. I saw people drinking at the restaurants, and it made me mad and frustrated. And anyway, so I drank again, and she told me to move out and work. We were going to work on ourselves for 90 days. And what I didn't know, she was a smart lady, and she was just, this was her way of getting me out, and that was it. So when I put some flowers on her door in July of 2004, she sent me a text and said, "Look, we're going to get a divorce." And so I was really resentful and angry because, you know, I felt like, you know, I think the vows say, for better or for worse, sickness or in health, you're supposed to stay together. And I felt like, you know, she was giving up on me. But I started partying right away, and I'd never been a bar drinker, but I started going to bars. And I was having a lot of fun, but I discovered that bar drinking is expensive. And so what I did is I started carrying a huge, like, 1.5 gallon or whatever those things are of Jim Beam in the back, and I would drink first before going in so I could save some money. But the problem was I couldn't predict how I would react to the alcohol. Sometimes I was fun and lively, and other times, this one time I woke up across the street, 3 blocks up, at this gas station, this Quick Trip, at like 2 in the morning in my car, and I called my friends and asked what happened. They said, "Yeah, the bartenders found you passed out on the toilet in the stall, and they just, you know, walked you out of the bar," and they were kind of pissed off. And somehow I'd driven, and it was back in that period that I started making deals with friends that I would pay for the drinks if they would drive. And this one time, this girl and I were doing that, so she was driving and I was buying the drinks. She was just a friend. And she was supposed to let me stay on her couch that night. Well, I woke up, and I was in the back of a cop car with handcuffs on, and I had fortunately driven the wrong way on the street. Instead of driving to Tulsa County, I'd driven into Bixby, and so it was misdemeanor DUI at the time, and I got lucky. And I called. I was supposed to start this new job. I'd gotten canned from my other one. They thought I was they were uncomfortable around me because I was this new party guy that had just gone and got a gun and a sports car and a tattoo. And I think they just, my wife actually worked in the same building for a different company, and they let me go with severance, but they made up something. I think they just didn't know what was up with me, but I went back to my old company, and they were, I was working as a contractor there, and they were going to hire me, a different business unit was going to hire me as this contract analyst for the midstream group, and I was excited, and I had also had an offer from this company down in Tesoro, this oil and gas company that had found me on Monster, and I was going to go ahead and turn them down and stick with the Tulsa company, but with that DUI, I was supposed to start the next day, and so I called my boss that I was supposed to start that day and said, listen, and hindsight's 20/20, I should have said, look, I'm terribly ill. I should have made something up, but I just told him the truth. And he said, okay, well, you know, call me later. You'll be fine. We can work this out. But then when I called him back, he just said, no, we can't have you. You're just going to have to, we're not going to be able to bring you on here. So then I was in a scramble to come get hired with this other company down here in San Antonio. And that's what brought me down here. So I came and started working in San Antonio, but by now, my drinking was no longer social. You know, there's some, the doctor's opinion has some pertinent points that I'd like to talk about. They talk about that I drank because I liked the effect produced by alcohol. I think a lot of us think, when I showed up and they told me, you know, that's the reason, that's, I just thought, kind of like, duh, yeah, of course I drank because I liked it, but I mean, that's one obvious reason. Obviously, it felt good. But this I like the second thing. It says, I was restless, irritable, and discontented until I could again experience the sense of ease and comfort that came at once with a few drinks. Drinks that I saw others taking with impunity, and that's the truth. I did see people on TV and in real life drinking, and they weren't slaves to this craving or this obsession for alcohol like I was. Another idea from the doctor's opinion is that I had a physical allergy, not just a mental condition. And it's true that several times I drank and ruined great opportunities for myself, as I talked about medical school, a good marriage. I mean, there was a lot of things that I did, but DUI, ruining the job there. I was drinking to overcome a craving beyond my mental control. And I really like this last quote from the doctor's opinion. It says, frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. And that's really interesting because frothy emotional appeal is what I would get a lot from my mom. Oh, Joe, in the name of Jesus, you just have to stop letting these demons and alcohol control your life. And you come and let the blood of Jesus, you know, cover you and be washed, you know, whatever. Because that was her experience. She was doing the best she could, right? When Reverend Younger showed up and knocked on the door and said, do you want to stop this life of drugs? She said, yes, I do. And she stopped and she never went back, you know. So for her, it was that simple. Make a decision. That's not what happened for me. So my alcoholism was becoming progressive, and I kind of had two options in San Antonio. I wanted to have a social life, but I also wanted to drink, and I knew if I drank, I could not drive. I did not want to get another DUI. So I was all about stocking the house with food, alcohol, everything, getting everything done, laundry, workouts, everything, so then I could just have my time on the weekends to just drink all I wanted. But the problem was I couldn't have any friends or girlfriends like that, because who wants to be around somebody that's just blitzed out of their mind? And I would work out, and I would come home, but I would always carve out like a couple hours at night to drink before I went to bed. And a couple of times I tried to have a girlfriend, it was just, it would always be weird, you know, because I'd always hit that point where I would hit oblivion, and then I never knew how I acted. And sometimes I was fine, I just went to sleep, but other times I said weird things, or I was threatening, or whatever, and so the relationships never lasted. And so I went from this idea of me when I got that divorce in 2004 and started doing the bars, where I thought, I'm just going to be party Joe. That's going to be me. I'm going to be fun. I'm going to hang out with these people. And it's going to be, you know, just like, you know, I was thinking of the movie Wedding Crashers, you know, when Vince Vaughn and Owen Wilson are having such a fun time all the time. And that's who I wanted to be, that guy. But at this point, I was beyond that. I knew that wasn't me anymore. I was going to be hard drinking Joe. And I was listening to darker music, you know, and identifying with those people. Like, there was a song by that band Stain. He's like, yeah, it's been a while since I, you know, got effed up again, something like that. And I don't remember how it goes. And, you know, the video shows him smoking a cigarette by himself, playing his guitar in the dark. And that was my experience exactly. I mean, I was in the dark playing my guitar, or else I was on the couch with my friends, which were, you people from Seinfeld and the movie, the show Friends. I mean, those were my friends. So that was my experience. So now I identify more with like that guy or like Mickey Rourke or Nick Nolte or these guys. Survivors, you know. So that was me. That was going to be my life, you know. And someday I was going to kind of figure it out. I was going to stay in shape and take care of myself and probably die a little young from liver disease. But who cares? At least I was happy and having fun, you know. But the worst, so this is kind of the progressive nature of my alcoholism, you know, because I kept letting pieces of my life get pulled off. And but yet I doggedly stuck to the drinking, you know. I do remember it's funny, I was with these people at work, we went to this wedding, and they were like having Patron and all this stuff, and it was fun, and I went out and I walked by to use the restroom, and I saw this girl that was in the party just sitting out there smoking, and so hey, what's going on? You know, I was a little tipsy, and so we talk, and she's having a drink and a smoke, so I figured she was a party girl, and so we ended up hanging out and partying together for a few months, and I didn't hide anything around her because I could tell she was a party girl, and you know, she had some tough times, and so I didn't, you know, she wasn't the kind of person that I necessarily identified with, but we had some fun together, and we were just having a good time, but after about 3 months, she said, "Hey, I have a question for you." I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Do you think you're an alcoholic?" And I just couldn't believe it that she would ask me that, you know, because I was hanging out with her, and to me, she was way worse than I was in every aspect. She smoked cigarettes, and yet she asked me if I was an alcoholic. That was that stung. And so we quit hanging out. What I found out later is pretty cool is that she was an AA retread. She had been in AA, and maybe she was thinking about coming back in. And she's in now, and she's sober, and that's pretty cool. I met her here in this room not 5 years ago, and I was glad to see her back, and she was glad to see me too. And so maybe that's why she asked me, you know, because she could tell. But the thing is, I was on this plan to be hard drinking Joe and somehow have a successful career and be healthy and figure it all out after that. The problem is I started getting these terrible chest pains. I worked out every day, like lifted weights and did a lot of cardio and spin bike and swimming and stuff. But all of a sudden I started getting these terrible chest palpitations. And I don't know what it was, but I would kind of cut my workouts and go easier. But for like weeks that I was getting this, it was just awful. And I finally got to the point where I couldn't stand working out anymore. So I would just go home and I would drink and not work out. And I started feeling just like a disgusting slob, you know. And it got to the point where I couldn't even climb the 3 flights of stairs to my apartment without getting these terrible chest pains. And that was miserable. So I realized this had to be related to the alcohol. And I went to a psychiatrist. I'd heard of antabuse, and I asked her for that. And she said, no. She said, antabuse is too dangerous. I just recommend that you taper down. And so I tried to taper down, and that didn't work. And my life was getting really bad. I was always behind on my finances. I thought if I bought liquor at the Costco liquor store, never went to bars, that I should be able to manage financially, but somehow it was still expensive, and I was doing these check cashing places. I tried to find a seedy part of town where I could do the check cashing places and nobody from work would see me. So I found right out here there's a check and go. And there's a Cash Advance America, and then there's a check and go, and then I could come behind the check and go, and so nobody could see me, and I cut through this back alley here, over these pumpy bumps through the alley, and I look and see all these people milling around, and I was like, I've got this, what is this weird bar or bowling club or what is it? And I looked back, and I forgot to mention that my mom did send me to treatment for 2 months since when I was 17, and so it was, I got a taste of AA meetings there, promptly forgot it. The day I got back, I started getting high again, but I knew what AA was, and I looked back one day after the fifth time I'd gone through this parking lot with all the people and stuff, and I saw the little AA decals over the door, and it was cool. It was here, just right out front here. So I knew where there was an AA place. And so a few months later, it was just getting so bad and unmanageable in every way. And so what this really illustrates in step one is there's two things we talk about. There's powerlessness and unmanageability. I can't promise you, but I'm 99% certain that if my life hadn't become unmanageable, I would never have showed up here, you know? So I had to get unmanageable and then try to cut back, taper down, stop whatever, find that I was powerless before I could ever ask for help and really be open to help. And the thing was, I finally did come in those doors one day on January 10th of 2008, and at noon on lunch, and went into that room there, and And it was the 12:15 meeting, and there was like four people or five people, and somebody was cheering, and I kind of, when I'm an alcoholic, everybody said that, and I said it, and kind of started crying a little bit, and talked to some people afterwards, and left, and got a sponsor a few days later, my same sponsor, Chrissy, and so there I was in AA, and I started trying to do the right thing, but one thing I had showed up with, I met the unmanageability part for sure. Health, finances, relationships were terrible. And I knew I was powerless because when I tried to stop drinking, I couldn't. When I tried to cut back, I couldn't, like it talks about on page 44. But the one thing I didn't have was I didn't have that thing on page 30 they talk about, that the idea that one day I can again drink like another alcoholic has to be smashed. And I know that I didn't have that because I kept drinking. Unlike my sponsor and some others who showed up, and I think they call them honeymooners, and never drank again, every Saturday I would relapse between January and March of 2008. And I would get a desire chip, and I would show up, and one time I just called my sponsor and said, look, you know, the Monday night meeting, I don't think I'm going to go. Well, why not? Man, I just don't want to bring those people down. I mean, I want them to feel good. You know, I don't want them to think this program's a failure or whatever. He said, they're fine. You're the one that needs help. Just come to me. And he was right. And those same people are still there in my home group. Bill Lim and Bill B and Ray A and Greg S and Chrissy and David J used to go there at the time or started at, right shortly after, and a bunch of people. And it was good for me. But I finally got sober in March 10th of 2008, and I stayed sober in July. They made me the GSR, really against my wishes. And so I started to feel pretty good about myself. Things were coming together. My finances were getting better. My body felt better. My blood was good. I got tested, and everything was fine. And then in September one day, I told my sponsor, Chris, I said, there's a work party for the new director of logistics, and I'd like to go to this thing. It's a dinner. I'm sure there will be some drinks there, but I'm just going to do my thing. Okay, fine. You know, just pray, make sure, you know, read pages 100 to 103 and do all that, and you should be fine. So I went to a meeting. It was a Saturday. I worked out. I went home. I took a nap, and I woke up from that nap on that sunny Saturday, and suddenly, plain as day, that thought crossed my mind. What if I'm not an alcoholic? What if I'm not? What if I'm going to spend the rest of my life in these gray rooms with these people, some of whom need to be here for sure? I'm going to think I'm an alcoholic, right? All the rest of my life. And I'm not. And, you know, I'm old enough. I don't know. Some of you older people will remember the Twilight Zone movies. And a lot of times it's kind of that theme where you think you're one of them, but you're not. You know? And that's, I thought, I can't stand the thought of that. And then another thought came and said, what do the overeaters do? Do they stop eating? No. They learn to eat the right way. That was all the logic I needed. I knew the book well enough to say on page 31, does it not say that if a man thinks he's not an alcoholic, our hats are off to him. He should go to the bar and verify it for himself. And so to me, that all was enough to make sense. So I sent this warm text message to my sponsor and several guys from my home group thanking them for their help and wishing them well. And I went out that night, and I went to the party, and afterwards I drank. And that Monday, I mean, it was like instantly transported back in time. And I was shaky, and, you know, I didn't want to go to work that Monday, and which is what I usually did in the past. And so I got there that night on Monday night and picked up a desire chip. And that kicked off some more craving, and I relapsed and stumbled and fumbled until December of 08. And I've been sober since December 8th of 2008, and I'm really thankful for that. It took a long time to get here. It took 20 years, really, to get sober. But I can tell you that my life's gotten better since then. But I won't tell you that it was pink cloud sobriety for me. I hear people talk about pink cloud. For me, it was like gray fog sobriety for the first 10 months, mixed with. And what's really great is the obsession to drink was taken then. It was awesome. Somehow I surrendered enough to let God just take that away, and that's really beautiful. And that idea that I could ever drink again like a normal alcoholic was smashed. But that didn't mean that life was rosy for me, because the thing was, I got sober and I looked and I created this pile of garbage for myself, this life. You know, I had completely destroyed my life, and it didn't look very inviting to spend the rest of my life trying to dig out of the mess that was my life now. And plus, it just sounded boring, and I didn't like the idea of my life. And I went through a lot of suicidal thoughts and had a lot of tough times. There were one time I didn't have guns at the time, and I was at Walmart shopping for looking at the shotguns because I was thinking about killing myself. And every time I went over to Action Pot in Fredericksburg, looking at guns for the same reason. And so in a lot of ways, life was grim. It started to slowly get better, but it wasn't great. I didn't sponsor anybody. I did a lot of service work. I set up chairs. I got there early to meetings. I was the GSR. Later, I became the secretary of our home group. So I really believe that service work and following direction of my sponsor is what kept me alive and sober. I mean, apart from God. I mean, those were huge aspects. But my life just wasn't great. And in July of 2011, I had this habit of when I get frustrated at work with my computer in my Excel spreadsheets or whatever, I would curse under my breath. And it made the people around me on the trade floor uncomfortable. I didn't know that. One time my boss, my old boss, who was now my primary client, I mouthed off to her an email and copied my boss on it. Say, hey, I've done the budget 5 years. I don't need you to micromanage me or something like that. And the next thing I know, I'm in HR with my new boss, and they give me a 90-day personal improvement plan to fix myself. And I can believe it. You know, this is my sobriety. This is the wonderful joy of sobriety that I find out 2.5 years sober, and this is it. You know, and I had to go home that night and really have a come-to-God meeting because I had the opportunity to adopt a resentment and go back to work with a kind of a negative attitude, and that would, or I could try to do some step work here and somehow see it as God working in my life. And I chose the latter, and it's been good for me there ever since. You know, things have improved. I switched departments in 2012, and since then I've actually had a couple of promotions, and things have been good. But during that time, I discovered something about myself. I started to dig down and discover my character defects during that hard 90 days where I had to go in and talk to those people about myself. And I had never understood. A couple times my sponsor had kind of politely suggested the idea of self-pity. But Chrissy is he's good, but he's not a hard ass. And he had never really called me out on some of my stuff. At least not that one. And I discovered for the first time that I had self-pity and that I was infused and full of self-pity. That before, the self-pity and me were so tightly entwined that I couldn't even see the difference. That felt like my reality. But somehow during that 90-day period, I realized that self-pity was one of my biggest character defects, along with rage, which we've talked about, and envy. And what I discovered, though, is there's a wonderful solution for self-pity and envy, and it's called gratitude. And I began to really seek gratitude and seek to be a grateful person, and that has really helped. I mean, the self-pity, now I see it float up, and it's just like, whatever. You know, it's like, it's easy to, it went away easy. The rage thing, I still, sometimes with computers and electronic devices, and traveling, but not like it was. But the self-pity and the envy thing, that's gone, because gratitude is a wonderful solution. So I've talked about service work. My relationship with God really helped there. Back in 2008, I had done my steps, but because of my religious experience, I kind of looked at steps 2, 3, 6, 7, and 11 as kind of like gimmies for somebody with a religious background. And I didn't really, I was like, yeah, I just wanted to complete the steps. You know, that was like my goal, complete the steps. And so I didn't really focus as much as I should have on steps 3 and 11 especially. And so during that time of that personal improvement plan in 2011, I really had to go back and revisit those and really think about what it meant to let God be my new employer, my director, and to start seeking God and allowing Him to guide my life. You know, if I didn't make sense to me, how do we let God guide my life? I mean, I'm the one that has to get up, brush my teeth, and go to work. It's not God doing it. I have to do it. So I think it's just common sense. It's kind of how I thought of it then, but that... I started giving pages 85 to 88 or 84 to 88 more credence and really trying to adopt those and incorporate those in my life in step 3. And my life has just gotten better and better and better. Still have some of those education loans that I racked up that I'm paying off. But health is good. Everything's good. I got married in 2011, and that's been wonderful. I have a good host of friends. I've had sponsees. I probably had 12 sponsees, two of whom I still talk to. One's sober 3 years and one has like one day of sobriety, but God bless them. It's been great for me. I can tell you that working with others, the one thing it really did for me was it like, I thought I understood the steps until I had to explain it to somebody else. Mm-hmm. And then it, like, crystallized and, like, came into focus in a way that I had never imagined that it would, and I understood it in a whole new way. So I highly recommend sponsorship. I'm running out of time here. I would like to put in a plug for Chuck C's book, New Pair of Glasses, because there he talks about uncovering, discovering, and discarding. And that was a useful tool for me. Also, of course, on page 84, really, we ask God to remove it at once when these things crop up. In step 10, you know, we ask God to remove it at once. We discuss it with someone immediately, make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone, and then resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. That last one is huge, you know, because I would never have done that in the past. I really want to invite everybody to join us on this journey, if you're not already, to be happy, joyous, free, and most importantly, useful. In dealing with sponsees and in seeing myself, I encourage you, if you're new or you've been struggling, not to try to psych yourself up to, like, in a football game or something, to be sober today, you know. that's not how it works. Sit back, allow yourself to feel your skepticism or whatever, but be willing to follow direction, do every single thing that's instructed of you, and then see if it works for you, and I'm sure that it will. I'd like to invite newcomers to join us on the road of happy destiny, and I'll read this one little passage here. Carry this message to other alcoholics. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they are very ill. Life will take on new meaning. To watch other people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends, this is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. Thank you.
Joe! Woo-hoo! All right.